Every month we have a conversation here on the show called Counter Stories. By people of color, for people of color, and everyone else, the group gets together to talk about items that have been in the news. And it's been a busy news week for sure. So I wanted to bring together the counter-storiers for their thoughts today, especially this week with the decision by the U.S. attorney here in Minnesota not to seek federal civil rights charges against the two police officers involved in the shooting death last year of a man named Jamar Clark in North Minneapolis. Clark's death led to weeks of protests and an occupation at a police station there in North Minneapolis. So here to talk about this today, Don Eubanks, an assistant professor of social work at Metropolitan State University. Hi, Don.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Halee Lee is a media artist in the Twin Cities. Hello.
Hello.
Luz Maria Frias, attorney with a public policy background. Hi.
Hey there.
I'm glad you're here.
Glad to be here.
And Jason Soule teaches criminal justice at Metro State and Hamline University, also works on criminal justice issues with the Minneapolis NAACP, sitting in this month for Anthony Galloway, but I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. Good morning.
I'm actually going to start with something you wrote, Jason, an op-ed. You co-wrote it in MinnPost here, and this was actually before. So this week we had that federal decision, and back in March we had the State Division decision not to press charges, and you had written before this. One of the things you wrote toward the end of the op-ed is, without even a trial, many of the eyewitnesses, many of the protesters, many of the citizens who passionately advocated for justice for Jamar will lose faith in the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. Given that the justice system, as it stands today, gives people like Mike Freeman and Andy Lueger the decision to make that decision, right, weighing the facts as they see them, why is it only justice if you have charges?
Because we spoke with a number of witnesses after it happened. So we actually can visualize Jamar Clark's last moment. So with the height of what happened and what's happening across the country, it's like we need justice in this matter. They have to be charged. First of all, the officer should have never been hired. You know, the officer who put him in a chokehold was fired from the San Diego Police Department. So we shouldn't have hired him in the first place. But beyond that, the nature of it, for it to happen in 61 seconds, for, you know, Mike Freeman to say it was based on DNA. It's like DNA doesn't say that Jamar Clark had his hand on the officer's firearm. And we all know that. And you had Patrick Sullivan, you know, on your show before on NPR. And he said, you know, I can shake your hand and you can touch your, you know, firearm and my DNA will be on it. So they've made erroneous claims. It was false and erroneous claims being made throughout. So we have to get justice in this matter because Jamar Clark should still be with us. He'll never get a chance to do the things that we're able to do.
There comes, though, Luz, as you've seen through this whole moment, that even some of the things Jason said are disputed. We're not even agreeing on the facts. And if we talk about rebuilding trust and we talk about getting to that next phase, I mean, we're not even starting from the same place, are we?
That's right. And trust really is critical. And I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that's the salient point that I think just keeps getting missed and glossed over. When members from the communities of color have interactions with police, it is typically one that is of a negative fashion and nature by way of the interactions, right? And we've all seen the statistics in terms of driving while black, driving while brown, and those interactions formulate the relationships that they have individually and collectively with police. And I juxtapose that with the white community. And I'm just looking right into your eyes,
do
right?
It. Go for
and
it.
What do you feel like when you're pulled over by police? And what does that interaction look like? And do you have that same history in terms of historical trauma and having those negative experiences? And that really informs the judgment and informs the narrative that we're hearing today. And it's not until you walk into those shoes that you really understand the dynamics that are there.
But then you get the moment of that press conference, right? You get the moment of these events where the person in that position who has that responsibility to weigh the facts says, here's what I see, and here's why I don't think there are charges. So you've just outlaid this, you know, this history leading up to it. But then that moment.
Well, and that moment really is the truth, the way it's being presented, actually factually true? And the basis for that questioning has to do, again, with the historical way that police reports have been written to be true and factual, but then they've been proven false by way of other evidence, whether it's video evidence or other personal accounts of witnesses that have interacted and seen that same instance. Certainly for decades, that technology was not at the retail level where everybody had access to it.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about iPhones.
iPhones and things everything. Of that sort. But now with the propensity of that being available, we have more of that coming into question. But this practice has been going on for decades. It's not new.
Helene?
Well, I think really going off that, I was thinking today about the press conference and how the community how community members were not allowed in the press conference. And I think that really turns the narrative, because for regular folks who aren't involved in Black Lives Matters or regular folks who don't follow this stuff, they're going to see that report from the federal government and they're going to say, well, look at that. The facts all line up to what they're saying. Obviously, they're not guilty. And then you hear the stories from the community. You hear the stories from people who have experienced being discriminated against, and it's like, you second think that, right? You go back and you say, well, the federal government is saying this, and we should believe them because that's what we do, right? They're the government. We should trust them. But you turn around and you hear personal accounts of it, and it's different. And so I think that's why not allowing community members into the press conference was a big deal, because it really turned the narrative.
As we heard, though, the accounts are not all the same. Andy Luger in his press conference says, we, knowing that this leads to a trial, right, if we do this, we're going to get shot down because we have all these eyewitness accounts, Jason, that are so different. Mm-hmm. And so to Halee's point, if everyone were saying the same thing, I get that. But according to Andy Luger, and I think even you would agree that they are not universal on what those eyewitness accounts are.
Yeah, that's why when I got the call, I was one of the first people down at the scene. And I know you got to get it fresh at the scene because, I mean, if you look at the research, it changes over time. You know, they see video, they hear accounts, and people start to forget what they actually saw. So I was there on the ground talking to people. I even encountered a 10-year-old boy who saw it. So, you know, that people get caught up on whether he was handcuffed or whether he wasn't handcuffed. But the fact remains he wasn't resisting. Regardless, in all accounts, there was no resistance from Jamar. Like, there were lies throughout. The officers didn't turn on their dash cam. They did. They made a ton of errors. So that should require a trial, if nothing else, the errors they made. And for 61 seconds for a life to be lost, I think that needs to be, like, further examined rather than a quick, we're not going to a grand jury, we're not indicting. So whether the accounts, you know, all align or not, we know Mike Freeman lied about a lot of things. Regardless, we can actually point to things. And we've exposed in a number of articles some of the lies that he's told already. So we got to actually make the narrative true. And right now they're pushing a false narrative.
We've also heard from the community that some of folks in the community have been coerced in terms of their statements, right?
Absolutely.
And having been pressured by some police officers regarding their ability to talk freely. Mm-hmm. And they have then recanted their statements based on that level of coercion. So that is a factor to be taken into account as to how something would appear to be one way, but then change another way.
But the other way to look at it, right, because there is pushback against that. There is pushback against that idea in saying you've now had two occasions where the presentation of facts for you, Jason, didn't go your way. And so now you're just looking for the next thing to nitpick, right, so that you can continue to say that this is all a big lie. Well, what happens if the fact that we had two straight events that said the same thing means it's not a lie, right?
Well, it's a lie. I lose sleep on this sometimes.
The bigger picture, right? And this is why, and we could nitpick every single detail, but that's the thing here.
Yeah.
That's the disconnect. There are plenty of people in the community who don't think it's a lie, who say, okay, I get it. They shouldn't be charged, and I get why.
Yeah, perception is one thing and reality is another. You know, what happened to him that day shouldn't have happened. And I'm dealing with some mourning family members and, you know, people, you know, his nephew was, you know, inconsolable the day of. And, you know, the way they handled it from when they pulled up, I was there when the BCA pulled up. You know, we did our press conference before they pulled up and they already came to the scene, you know, with a lackluster, you know, mentality. It was like, okay, let's just get through this. And we didn't really want them there. But I saw how they were questioning community members. And it wasn't like, I want to help you. You know, I'm here to serve you. It was more so, let's get through the day. Let's get through it. And when they questioned the young boy, they were asking him questions like, were the handcuffs you saw orange or were they gray? And it was already an air of, we have to disprove what you're saying, you know, as truth. So they approached the scene with the protection of officers mentality rather than let's see what really happened here so we can actually have justice in this, because we're not getting justice. And you can look all around. There is no justice for, you know, black or brown people.
And that even goes, of color. That even goes towards the way that the press conferences were held and the narrative that did come out of it, because my issue was with the announcement this week was we can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. Which is, and that, so you're I get saying that. That was the statement from
right.
the
right. So
US
I get
attorney.
That, right? You can't prove. We can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was handcuffed or not, but he wasn't. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the narrative that came out of it. It's like, no. Just if you can't prove it, whether they're on or off, end the sentence there. But then they go and they support, but he wasn't.
Well, I have to clarify, because he started from a point of, we have to decide whether the handcuffs were on, because that could lead to a way, the way the rights, the civil rights laws are written. Mm-hmm. If the handcuffs were on, that does lead us down the road towards civil rights being violated. And so he did not start from that question. He started from the question of, were they on?
Right.
And he says, but that's different than what you said.
Yeah.
He said that, are they on? Here's what we saw. Here's our evidence.
We can't prove that they were on or off.
No, we can't prove that they were on. And our evidence suggests they were off. That's a distinction that's important to make.
But, you know, I want to challenge that in terms of the evidence suggests that they were not on, because they relied on one piece of evidence, which was there was no bruising around his wrists. Mm-hmm. That is not conclusive. There have been many, hundreds of cases where folks are handcuffed and there aren't any bruises. So that in and of itself is not determinative or dispositive of the issue, yet the way it's framed for the layperson, it appears to be dispositive. So it is about raising questions and allowing them to be questions rather than beginning to use the evidence to speak one way to support your position. So we don't know that. We don't know one way or the other definitively, but it's troublesome to begin to hear that because there are no bruises, therefore there was no handcuffing.
Right, beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
And reasonable, that's the word where people can actually play around with.
Right.
And that's reasonable doubt, reasonable suspicion. That's where they actually can, you know, actually craft a narrative around the reasonableness. But we understand that, you know, officers have a tough job. But being a person of color, we have tough lives. So we got to understand there's a tone when officers approach the scene that determine or dictate how that actually plays out. And when they have the cushion of the county attorneys and other people colluding with them, it's not fair. It doesn't make us feel like we can trust that system, because it continues to happen. It's like we die in the streets, and if we're not physically being killed, our voices are silenced. There were a number of people who came forth. Why wasn't their testimony actually really taken into consideration? It was more about the narrative of the officers. I fear for my life. He had a 1,000-yard stare. And even saying a 1,000-yard stare, if you really look that up and do research around it, a 1,000-yard stare doesn't mean I'm about to hurt you or harm you. It means I've been so traumatized that I'm in a tizzy. And they push these narratives. You know, Jamar Clark had this 1,000-yard stare, and then he said, I'm ready to die. Nobody can verify that. Not even the EMTs that were on the scene. So they pushed a narrative, and it's like they can continue to do this, and it only creates further divisiveness with our community.
But is it collusion, when you said that was collusion with the prosecutors, or is it simply, and you know, more innocently, I guess I would put it, it's not collusion, it's simply that the body of law we have created over the generations does offer more protections for police in their line of duty. And so that it wouldn't, is it really collusion, or is it simply, in this case, the prosecutor, quote unquote, doing his job, saying, here's the laws I have to work with, and we don't meet that standard?
I think it's both. I think it's both, but I do think they work together in tandem. I think they're a team when it comes down to it. You know, they're the ones, they don't have much relationship with people of color. They don't. they have more relationship with each other in the field. They rub shoulders. They talk. And usually, you know, the police and the prosecutor work together to solve cases. So they don't want to be the people who stand out and say, nope, that was, you know, wrong. I'm going against you on this, because they have such a, you know, intimate relationship. So there is collusion. And the laws are flawed to protect officers rather than the people they serve.
Don, you want to get in here?
Well, yeah, I'm just listening to the conversation. I'm just thinking of my own personal experience. Because I was born and raised in Minneapolis, and yeah, I can think of a time about 20 years ago. I just happened to stop to pick up my brother-in-law on Golden Valley Road and in Thomas in North Minneapolis, and so he had just gotten into my car, and we had pulled out onto Golden Valley Road and had only gone a half a block, and a squad Minneapolis police squad car drove by us, and I just kind of watched in the rearview mirror as he whipped this U-turn. Mm-hmm. And something told me that we were going to be pulled over. And sure enough, within 5-10 seconds, we were pulled over, ordered out of the car by gunpoint. Within 10 seconds, three other squad cars pulled up. Everybody jumped out with their riot guns, all pointed at me and my brother-in-law. In the meantime, I'm being asked to assume the position against one of these police officers' car. So when I turn around and asked him what position that was, or, you know, I was to assume some position, he got mad at me and said, oh, you've never been arrested before? And I said, no, I've never been stopped before. So he told me to put my hands on his car, which I did. I put my hands on his car. He said, no, not like that. And then he came over and kicked my feet back so that I was splayed on his car. This, he held me and my brother-in-law while they were rifling through my car. This whole incident lasted about 5 minutes. Then everyone kind of backed away and they started hopping in their cars, and a couple of cars drove off. So I asked one of these officers, because now I'm traumatized. I've never had guns pointed at me before. And I asked this police officer, what the heck was this all about? And he actually told me, he said they had got a report that two black guys were driving around North Minneapolis stealing stereos out of cars, and one of them had on a gray top. I happened to have on a gray sweatshirt. Mm-hmm. So I looked at him and I said, if you were in Edina and you had a report that two white guys were stealing stereos and one of them had on a gray top, would you pull over every two white guys you saw in a car that matched that description? And of course, he didn't give me an answer. So and I just relate that because it comes back to the mentality of this whole thing. I mean, because we're framing this whole conversation within the framework of laws. Mm-hmm. I'm Native American, and, you know, laws are made by those who are in power to protect those who are in power. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it. And so as a Native American, we can see how the course of laws have changed to fit the United States and the federal government, especially in their dealings with us as Native Americans. And it's no different when we look at this whole situation. And we're not even touching on people's attitudes, or, you know, I mean, you teach in criminal justice, Jason, and you know what I'm talking about in terms of some of the attitudes of some of the young men that show up to become police officers.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You know, Don, I'm so glad that you shared your story. And what I wanted to emphasize, that unfortunately that's not limited to an interaction 20 years ago. We know that is a daily occurrence. We know a good friend of mine who is a high-level senior executive at Target was stopped at gunpoint on a Sunday morning in North Minneapolis when he was dropping off his son for a soccer game. And in fact, Tom, we learned this weekend that one of your colleagues, who's African-American, was stopped for driving while black. This is in North Minneapolis. This is happening every single day. And these are the experiences that help. They are the lived experiences that shape and formulate how we think in the communities of color about police and how those police interactions are so much different than what they would be in the white community.
I was just going to ask,
you know, as part of the conference, press conference that they had, they said, well, now we're going to work together with the community mm-hmm. on how we can better the relationship between police and the communities of color. And that's the next step, because if one good thing came out of this, it's that we're going to start this mission. And that really just sat really unwell with me. And I was just wondering how you guys all felt about that.
Mm-hmm. Those are not authentic conversations. I've been having a ton of conversations even before Jamar Clark was killed, but those are not genuine conversations. Those are conversations just to say you met with the community. That's it. You know, I talked to, you know, Don, you know, I talked to, you know, Jason Soul, NAACP, I talked to this person, but those are not authentic conversations. We need to change the policies. We need to change the way things are happening, because you got to see that it's familiar what's happening. You know, it's like when I see somebody on a stretcher and it's like, you know, they were killed. You know, I see Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland. It's like I keep seeing these people and it's like, no, it's way too familiar. When I see what's happening in schools, kids being abused in St. Paul Central, and it's like, man, it's everywhere and we need relief. We're running out of places to go. We are, because it's like we're under attack for no reason, just simply from existing. And it has to stop. Like, I got hundreds of stories like Don. Hundreds. Well, I've been choked in handcuffs. Like, people know these narratives already. I've been through the gamut with law enforcement, and it's like I don't even need that to explain or to tell the story. It's like so much material out there. It's like if you don't realize by now, you will never realize it. So things have changed over time. That's why we wore shirts at the press conference that says slavery never ended in America. It hasn't. It's been morphed. It's been, you know, conformed. It's been, you know, utilized in so many different ways that it's so mystified that it's hard to catch it. But in these cases with law enforcement, it's pretty easy to see what's happening.
We're having a conversation here with the Counter Stories group of Don Eubanks, Halili, and Luz Maria Frias, and Jason Soul is sitting in here today as well as we talk about this news here today. Here at NPR News. When I heard Don's story, I then imagined, okay, so then Don, when you heard about, you know, the Jamar Clark case, or when you hear about any incident, right, that raises suspicions about how that person was treated, I would suspect that in your brain, you went back to your own lived experience. So even though the facts of whatever case just happened may play out however they play out, you have an impression in your head that says, gosh, I remember that from 20 years ago.
Well, it's not just that one incident, Tom. It's you know, I'm born and raised in Minneapolis and grew up in North Minneapolis. And, you know, ever since I guess I reached consciousness and one becomes aware, I think I've shared this in an earlier Counter Stories podcast. Mm-hmm. You know, when you realize that you're half black and half American Indian, Native American, and that your life was not going to be like Leave It to Beaver, that, you know, that you'd been growing up in school, you're taught in school about slavery, you're taught about Indians, it's all been negative, and then all of a sudden you realize, gee, I came from slavery, and I'm one of the indigenous original inhabitants of this country, and we haven't been treated fairly on either side. When you hit that consciousness, and the police departments, our interactions with the police department wasn't one about protect and serve. It was about occupation. And so you grow up in that environment and you have a whole different perspective of what it says mm-hmm. to protect and serve. It may happen now where I live now, where I currently live, you don't see the police. Right. I mean, I get the impression they actually are protecting and serving. Unfortunately, whenever I drive in my community and the only time I see them have people pulled over, they happen to be people of color. And there aren't that many of us that live there. So, yeah. But you draw from those experiences. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, on Counter Stories here, we talked about Jamar Clark. We talked about Freddie Gray. We talked about Michael Brown. I mean, we had a whole series. Mm-hmm. We talked about that young kid in Cleveland where the response time for Jamar Clark and this young man were both like just a minute under. I mean, I think for the young kid, it was
like
12
seconds.
Four seconds. And he's dead. You know, it's this idea that as a person of color, we can die within minutes in any police encounter, regardless of what it's for. We are taught very young how to interact. I don't know any person of color who would legitimately stand in front of two armed police officers and utter anything close to, I'm ready to die. I'm sorry. It just doesn't fit the narrative. And unless, you know, you come from a particular element, most of us are, you know, we're going to say, yes, sir, no, sir, right away, sir. I mean, you know, because we don't want to die.
You know, you think big about criminal justice. I know you do, Jason, because you teach it. And to Don's point, the legal system that we have was largely created by, you know, white America, right? I get mm-hmm. that. And there is this premise in law that says each individual incident on its own facts, right? Each
yep.
thing is judged on its own. So mm-hmm. when Jamar Clark happened and the prosecutors were deliberating, technically speaking, there was no Michael Brown. There was no Eric Gardner mm-hmm. because the set of facts have to be right in that circle.
Mm-hmm.
But to what Don is saying and what you're saying, and well, everybody's saying here, is there a place? And I don't experience that, right? As a white person, I get that. That compartmentalizing in my brain is very easy mm-hmm. to think about. But are you thinking long term that the criminal justice machine somehow changes to incorporate that? That somehow that the premise of judging an individual case on its own merits mm-hmm. should change? That it should include what happened, the Freddie Brown, or the Freddie Gray, you know
what
I mean?
No, I'm not asking that you clump them all together. I'm not asking you to do that, but let's speak in truth. Like, stop protecting, you know, killer cops. I mean, if we really want to have trust in law enforcement, we have to actually see them performing their jobs in a as humanely as they possibly can. So what we're seeing and what we saw just from the little bit of footage that we saw of Jamar Clark on the you know, from the cams of the EMTs
right.
and different things like that, he wasn't in a place where he was acting as if he was ready to die. He was actually going to check on Rayanne Hayes, but the narrative was it was a domestic violence call where this woman said she had been abused. That shapes what happens beyond that, and none of them people are being held accountable. It's resting on a 24-year-old who's dead, who can't speak for himself. And it's like, that's not fair. Like, as a criminal justice educator, everything I'm reading and studying and even my own research says this system is working exactly how it's supposed to work, to keep certain people in subjugation and lift up other people. So I can't say that we should clump all the cases together, but they're very familiar. And I think with the Black Lives Matter movement, you actually having these kind of discussions more readily, but it has to be action steps along with it. So I'm all for the deliberative dialogue or the conversations, but I need to see systemic changes, because I'd be darned if that stuff happened to one of my kids, man. I can't live with that. So I need to change things now.
Luce?
Tom, you know, the question you asked about the law, you can't, it has to be individualized, right?
Right.
I mean, in terms of due process and the protections we have under the Constitution, we can't do that. But I do invite you to go further into the prospect of changing the law. In particular, I had been reviewing the findings from the Ferguson Commission and the Department of Justice findings, you know, 133 pages worth, about what needs to happen differently. And the first one would be in terms of revising the use of force policies and the laws associated with that so that it's proportionate to the incident that is being held at question, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think most people would agree that the use of force that we saw in Jamar Clark was beyond, and it's not proportionate to the incident for which he was being questioned or wanting to be held, right? No matter if you give the givens on all of the questions, the use of force was not appropriate. So that's the first part of it. The other part of it, and there's a whole list and I'm not going to go, but the two salient ones are the use of force, and the other one is de-escalation tactics. the use of de-escalation tactics is really paramount in terms of preceding how police interacts with community and any community, not just communities of color, the broader community as a whole. It should be one that takes into really account of what has to happen to get to the end product. And we know that police officers have to make, you know, split-second decisions. I take that into account. But de-escalation tactics, one of them is that there's 20 feet between the subject that's being questioned and yourself as an officer. If that subject starts coming towards you, that 20 feet then is reduced. One de-escalation tactic is, as a police officer, you adjust your own space, meaning that you actually take some steps back. There are police departments around the country and around the world that do have de-escalation practices that are smarter, quote unquote, that actually are much more functional and effective to allow for a different outcome.
Tom, let me throw in one other caveat to this discussion, because the discussion is being framed on kind of the legal side. I just want to share an experience with one of the students I have in my social work program, young white woman who originally was in criminal justice and now has switched to social work. She relayed a story where she worked as a security guard at the Mall of America. Because of her upbringing and the impact of stereotypes and prejudices that she had learned growing up as a young white woman here in the Twin Cities, she admitted that when she worked as a security guard at the mall, when she would be approached by black individuals, she would have this negative thoughts about this encounter because of what she was taught about black people. She relayed one such of these incidences where a family came up to her. She said her mind immediately kicked into this negative mode, and then she was totally surprised at how nice, how open, and they were just lost looking for a place to go. It made her question herself of why she reacted like that every time she was approached by a black person.
Yeah.
And so you throw that ingredient in on top of these, what we're talking about, you can't policy that stuff out. You can't create a law that's going to make that correction. And that tends to be the root cause, I believe, that drives many of these incidences and how these individuals react when they get in these situations.
I think definitely we can't put those cases all together and say, in an illegal form, that the cops are guilty because of all these cases. But we do need to recognize the trends that are happening and the narratives that are being told about this. If you take the report for what they said, there's a lot of little details missing. But it sounds really good, right? It sounds like, oh, yeah, they did their research. Here are the facts. And then if you go and you really dig deeper and you start listening to the stories of the witnesses, you start listening to people who've had interactions, people of color who have had interactions with these cops, you look at the history of these cops, then you start to doubt. I mean, that was what I experienced the first time there was the announcement, the state announcement was, it seems really good. It seems like they did their research and these guys didn't do anything wrong. And then I dug deeper and I started to doubt that, right? And that's just, I think that they're relying on the community to take what they say face forward.
In our final minutes here, Jason, I want to come to a comment we have online here from Mark, because, you know, I think this gets to that we're not all starting from the same place. We're not necessarily having the same conversation, because Mark says this type of fear, he's talking about this show, this very conversation, this type of fear mongering is only making the problem worse. We need to teach our kids to respect authority, not fear it. I don't know Mark's race, but you know, that's coming in from the online comments that we're having the wrong conversation.
No, we're having the right conversation. Some people won't get it. You know, some people won't actually listen to my views. You know, first day of classes, you know, sometimes I'm the first black professor any of my students have ever encountered. And yes. they got all these running themes in their head, and they got all these thoughts and perceptions about me as a black man. So people can say respect authority. I respect everyone. If you know me, you know I respect everyone until I'm disrespected. Now, you disrespect me, we're in a different different space. But for me, you can say respect authority all you want, but if you grew up in a town of 300, 400, or 1,000, and you never saw anybody who looked like me, and all you have is the negative images on the 10 o'clock news, 11 o'clock news, you're not going to value me. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a number of people who get into the field to play cops and robbers or whatever you want to name it, and then when they don't, you know, have a critical incident, they're creating one. So it's like the lens that people form on life is like actually showing up in the field, and it's like lives are actually being lost. But there's a few parts that we're missing. We need to talk about the white supremacy in law enforcement, and we're not talking about it. Like, I can go on and on about Bob Crow, but it's so many with that mentality and actually connections to white supremacist groups, and we don't say anything about it. But also, there's a lot of people in the field with these masculinity ideologies. You look at a lot of the, you know, shootings and killings, those are predominantly men. I would say over 90% are men. When they don't feel like you're respecting their quote unquote authority, as Mark suggested, they take it to a higher level because it's like, no, you're going to respect me now. Like Don's story, it's like, no, do what I say now or this could be the end of your life. So I can respect authority if it's fair, but we're not seeing fair process taking place. So we need a do-over.
Unfortunately, we have to end it there. I know, we'll get another one.
I just had to say, Tom, that comment, your comment just totally discounts who we are as people of color in American
Indians.
And
people who have experienced this.
Exactly, and it's those kind of comments that just totally discount everything that we say.
And I'm going to plug the Implicit Association Test. It's a test that you can take online, private test that Harvard University and a couple of other universities partnered with. Taken over 20 million times, you know, by 20 million people across the world, that teaches you about your own biases.
We'll put that online, and we'll continue this conversation for sure. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.